We keep wondering about many things happening around us, or things that happened in the past, and even things that will happen in the future, and we find in most cases that we have no clue, or we have a vague explanation at best. But that's okay, because these things keep driving us to learn more, trying to understand the mysteries all around us, and that's what makes us humans, after all. In today's episode of our Great Mystery series, we will explore some of these questions. What is hidden in the Emperor's tomb besides the Terracotta Army? Where is Genghis Khan's tomb? Was Machu Picchu a sacred site? Where is the Holy Grail? Can science find the source of consciousness? Why do we yawn? What's the point of laughter? What is dark matter? What triggers an earthquake? Will we ever find Amelia Earhart? What happened to the Neanderthals? And finally, how will the universe end? These questions will be our quest in today's new episode from our Great Mysteries series. And now, without further ado, let's start with our first question for today. What is hidden in the Emperor's tomb? China's first emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, wielded power as only a despot can. Uniting China's warring states in 221 BC, the emperor standardized weights and measures and built roads, canals, and defensive walls throughout his realm. He also burned books and executed scholars. His most monomaniacal project, however, was his own legacy. Obsessed with immortality, the emperor conscripted some 700,000 laborers to build a city-like tomb, guarded by a vast terracotta army. Thousands of these warriors, each vividly painted, have been uncovered by archaeologists. Half-sized bronze horses and chariots also have been unearthed, along with valuable artifacts made of silk, linen, jade, and bone. Craftsmen, concubines, and sacrificed slaves were buried in the compound as well, and the workmen who built were killed to preserve its secrets. According to Han Dynasty historian Sima Qian, the tomb contains wonders, a scale model of the entire empire, complete with birds of gold and silver, flowing rivers of mercury, and a map of the sky with constellations of pearls. Chinese archaeologists are reluctant to disturb the delicate structure, but tests indicate that the tomb does contain high amounts of mercury. Most of the mausoleum remains uncovered and unknown. The emperor himself has not been uncovered, and it is unclear if he ever will be, which would no doubt satisfy the autocratic ruler. So, that was about the hidden emperor's tomb. And that was our first question in today's Great Mysteries episode. But that's not everything. We still have a lot of questions to explore. And our very next question also has to do with tombs, but this time it is not the Chinese emperor. We're talking about Genghis Khan. Where is Genghis Khan's tomb? That is coming next, so don't go away. In his day, he was the terror of the world. Genghis Khan, or Chinggis Khan, built an army of ruthless horsemen and swept across Asia and into Europe in the 13th century, slaughtering entire cities and building pyramids of skulls. At its height, his empire spanned 12 million square miles, or 31 million square kilometers, from the Mediterranean to the Yellow Sea. The Mongol leader bred as efficiently as he fought. Today, about 16 million people carry genes that can probably be traced to the conqueror. When Genghis Khan died in 1227, however, he vanished, and the location of his tomb has been one of history's best-kept secrets. Apparently, he wanted it that way. Although legend has it that the leader was taken back to his homeland in Mongolia for an elaborate burial, some versions also state that the ground was then trampled by horses and planted with trees to hide the tomb's presence, after which the entire burial procession was murdered. Explorers are now using non-invasive techniques to survey the Mongolian landscape from the air in hopes of identifying ancient structures, such as burial mounds. So far, the land has kept the remains of the world's greatest conqueror well hidden. So, that was and still is one of the greatest mysteries when it comes to finding one of the world's greatest conquerors' final resting place. And we move from Genghis Khan and Mongolia all the way to South America and Machu Picchu. This is our very next question. And the question is, was Machu Picchu a sacred site? That's coming next, so don't go away. Hiram Bingham, the explorer who brought the Peruvian site of Machu Picchu to the world's attention in 1913, called it the Lost City of the Incas. He believed the complex of stone palaces, temples, stone houses, and dwellings might have been the one-time city of Vilcabamba, where Inca rulers fought a losing battle against Spanish invaders. Or else, Bingham argued, it was the home of Virgins of the Sun, holy women dedicated to the Inca sun god. More recent research has dashed Bingham's romantic theories. Machu Picchu was certainly an Inca city, but not Vilcabamba, and no trace of sacred virgins has been found. Given that the Inca left no written records, however, archaeologists are still uncertain of the mountainous city's purpose or inhabitants. Recent theories suggest that the steeply terraced buildings may have been built as a retreat for the great Inca Emperor Pachacuti in the 15th century. On the other hand, the site does appear to be a holy one, enclosed by the sacred Urubamba River and aligned to the solstices. Machu Picchu may have been a site of spiritual pilgrimage, or possibly both, a royal residence and a sacred destination. Researchers continue to excavate the site, hoping to find clues to the impressive city's inhabitants and the reason for its abandonment in the 1570s. So, that was about Machu Picchu, and we will move from Machu Picchu to another area of the world and another great quest. This quest that inspired many legends, many tales, even books and movies, and it still inspires to this very day. And here we're talking about the Holy Grail. The question is, where is the Holy Grail? That is coming next, so don't go away. Though it is traditionally held to be the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper, the Holy Grail as such did not appear in literature until the 12th century when French poet Chrétien de Troyes wrote Percival, The Story of the Grail. In this unfinished romance, the Grail is a serving dish, one of several mystical objects paraded before the young Percival. The Grail was not associated with the Last Supper until the next century in Robert de Boron's poem Joseph of Arimathea. From there, the legend of the Grail blossomed along with Arthurian romances in a mix of Celtic and Christian symbolism, fact and fancy. It was the object of literary quests, particularly that of the pure Sir Galahad. Some said the Knights Templar rescued it from Jerusalem and hid it all too successfully. Many locations from Spain to Maryland have claimed to possess the true Grail. The Grail is almost certainly a purely literary invention. Historians believe that if any cup used by Jesus did somehow survive all these centuries, it would be unidentifiable today, hidden indeed by time. Maybe it is, maybe it is not, who knows? But what we know for sure is that nobody can tell you for sure where the Holy Grail is, or even better, what the Holy Grail is, if there is any. So, that was our next question in today's episode of Great Mysteries. And our next mystery has to do with science and consciousness. And our question is, can science find the source of consciousness? That is our next question. Don't go away. It's an old, old question tackled by philosophers and scientists and children alike. What is this self that experiences the world? Is our sense of subjectivity, of identity, or sentience strictly a physical result of our big brains? Or is the mind distinct from the body? Scientists have typically approached the question from the perspective of brain structure. Perhaps, some theorize, there is a critical point at which the sheer number of neuronal connections between the cerebral cortex and the rest of the brain gives rise to conscious experience. From a physical perspective, our experience of the world seems to arise from the organized interaction among the emotional, sensory, and executive portions of the brain. This still leaves many questions, however. Are we unconscious when asleep? What about when we take action before becoming aware of our decision? Could an advanced computer become conscious? Many also wonder, are we the only conscious animals? Not according to the 2012 Conference on Consciousness in Human and Non-Human Animals. Scientists at the meeting, after reviewing studies of such animals as gray parrots, elephants, and octopuses, issued a declaration that said, among other things, the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates that generate consciousness. So, what we know for sure is that science still can't answer this question clearly. We have theories, so it is still a mystery. Until we have a clear answer, we cannot say that we do understand what consciousness is all about. So, can science ever find the source of consciousness? I guess time will tell. But that is one other mystery and one other question in today's episode, Great Mysteries. That's not everything. Remember, we still have a few questions to tackle in this episode. And our very next question is something that might seem too regular to you to be a mystery at all, but it is a mystery. And this is about yawning. Why do we yawn? That's what we're going to talk about next, so don't go away. Snakes do it. Cats do it. Even fetuses in the womb do it. All sorts of animals yawn, and we don't know the reason why. When we yawn, we extend our jaws and inhale, our eardrums stretching. Then we exhale. People yawn when tired or bored, but also when nervous. It's pretty much an involuntary act. Well, you can fake yawning, but it's not quite the same. The logical theory that yawning expels carbon dioxide from a tired body, helping it to wake up, has been largely debunked. However, the very movement may stimulate alertness. Increased levels of neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine are associated with increased yawning, whereas a boost of endorphins reduces yawns. Recent research has focused on temperature. When we yawn, our maxillary sinus, which is an air-filled sac next to the nose, expands and pumps cool air to the brain. Scientists have found that brain temperature rises just before a yawn and drops afterward. Yawns are famously contagious, at least among most humans and some animals. Studies show that people who are more empathic are more likely to yawn when they see others do it. Even dogs, highly attuned to social cues, will yawn when they see a human yawn. Infants and autistic children, on the other hand, do not. So, do we have a reason? Do we have a clear reason why we yawn? Absolutely not. We have theories, but we don't have a clear answer. And that's why this question qualifies to be in our series, Great Mysteries. And that was one of our great mysteries. And the next one has to do with something similar, but not yawning. We're talking about laughter. What's the point of laughter? That's coming next. Don't go away. Understanding laughter is different from understanding humor, although both are mysterious in their own ways. The short vocalized exhalations and stretched facial muscles that constitute laughter are involuntary responses evident in humans from about 3 or 4 months of age. The sound seems to be controlled by older parts of the brain associated with breathing. Not surprisingly, it reduces stress and produces positive feelings. Neurons associated with pleasure light up in scans when people laugh. People laugh most often in ordinary, that is, not especially funny situations. Researchers observing social interactions found that laughter most typically followed routine observations, such as, here comes Mary, or how did you do on the test? Laughter seems to have less to do with humor, per se, than it does with social bonding. People share laughter when danger has passed. They seem to use it to promote trust as well as indicate a place in the social hierarchy. Dominant figures in a group laugh the most. Just why this physical response evolved in this way and how humor triggers it are still in question. And who knows? The answers may turn out to be funny, but we still don't have them. And that's why this question qualifies to be one of our mysteries in today's episode. And now, moving on to something that is really mysterious and kind of difficult, that most people don't know anything about that thing, and we're talking about dark matter. What is dark matter? You might have heard of it, you might have heard of it in movies and stuff, or read about it somewhere, but most people don't know what dark matter is. And I don't want to disappoint you, I'm not going to tell you what dark matter is, because we don't actually know what it is. But that is why it is a mystery, and that's what we're going to talk about next, so don't go away. Swiss astronomer Fritz Zwicky, studying rotating galaxy clusters in the 1930s, came to an unsettling conclusion. At the speeds he observed, the clusters should be flinging their stars into space like unfortunate children who had lost their grip on a merry-go-round. The only way the clusters could be holding together would be if they contained much more mass than anyone had seen. Later measurements of galactic motion cemented the mystery of dark matter. Physicists now believe that about 27% of the matter in the universe consists of this unknown substance, which doesn't emit or reflect light. Dark matter might consist of ordinary, unseen objects such as massive brown dwarf stars and black holes. Scientists have a second candidate, though, weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs for short. These exotic particles would have very little mass individually and therefore be hard to detect, but could be so numerous and widespread that they would have the requested gravitational effect. Experiments aboard the International Space Station have detected high-energy particles that might, maybe, just possibly have been cast off by the collision of particles of dark matter. But do we have clear answers? Do we have definitive answers to that? What is dark matter? No one knows for sure. We all have theories about that. Maybe we will know in the future, maybe we won't. And maybe when we know it, it's not going to be that big of a deal, or it is going to change our very understanding of the universe. Who knows? But that is another mystery to add to our great mystery series. And the next one has to do with earthquakes. Now, we all know earthquakes. We all know how they work. But what triggers an earthquake? You might say that, yeah, we learned that at school, and we know exactly what triggers an earthquake. Well, think again, because we don't have a clear answer to this specific question. What triggers an earthquake? And that's coming next, so don't go away. The earthquake that struck in 1211 off the east coast of Honshu, Japan's largest island, was a nightmare come to life. The magnitude 9 quake and resulting 97-foot-high or 30 meters tsunami killed more than 15,000 people and destroyed more than 300,000 buildings. No one predicted the quake, because no one could. Scientists know the basic mechanism of earthquakes. Simply put, for earthquakes not related to a volcanic eruption, two blocks of earth sliding along a fault line build up energy from friction and then suddenly release it when a block overcomes the friction and jolts forward. The energy then moves in waves through the ground, shaking the surface. Many mysteries remain, however. Why, for instance, does the friction suddenly ease? Does the rock become molten along the fault, or powdery, like talc? Why are so many earthquakes minor when lab simulations predict they should be devastating? Pressure from water in reservoirs or wastewater injected into the ground during natural gas drilling seem to sometimes trigger quakes. But how? And are these quakes dangerous? We don't have firm answers to these questions, and science is still at a loss to predict the next disaster. Well, this is one mystery we hope we can find the answer to very soon, because if that mystery gets solved, we can save a lot of lives. If we can predict earthquakes, when we understand what triggers an earthquake, we might be able to predict it precisely when it's going to happen, where it is going to happen, and how strong it is going to be. But unfortunately, this is one more mystery to add to our great mystery series. And our next one has to do with a very famous woman that just disappeared. And I'm talking about Amelia Earhart here. My question is, will we ever find Amelia Earhart? That is our next question. Don't go away. Ship's captains are told never to utter the fateful words, "This will be my last voyage." And perhaps Amelia Earhart should have followed that advice. Planning for her round-the-world flight in 1937, she told a friend, "I have a feeling there is just one more flight in my system." Earhart was world famous. She was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic and the first person to fly from Hawaii to California. An around-the-globe journey was the final challenge. Accompanying her when she took off on June 1, 1937, was an experienced navigator, Frederick Noonan. The first legs of the trip were arduous, but the 2,556-mile or 4,114-kilometers Pacific leg from New Guinea to Tiny Howland Island was the toughest of all. From the air, Earhart radioed that she couldn't see the island and was running low on fuel, then silence. The largest rescue effort ever launched searched unsuccessfully for Earhart, and searches continue to this day. The aviator could simply have crashed into Pacific waters. Some believe she landed on Nikumaroro Island, where castaways were once reported. Others think that in those years before World War II, she and her companion were captured by the Japanese. No clues have so far surfaced to lead anyone to Earhart's final resting place. And that is really a shame, because Amelia Earhart is a real hero. And one really wants to know what happened to her, or where's her final resting place is. But unfortunately, until this very day, we cannot have an answer to that question. And now we still have two more questions in today's episode, and we will begin right away with the Neanderthals. Well, you might have heard of the Neanderthals, and you know that they came before Homo sapiens, and without going into so much detail, we might know that they were not the clever version of human beings that grew more powerful and more intelligent to build civilizations. But one question that is still puzzling to this very day is, what happened to the Neanderthals? Obviously, they were strong. Maybe they were not as clever, but they were strong. So how did they just vanish? What happened to the Neanderthals is our very next question, so don't go away. As they moved into Europe and Eurasia some 30,000 to 50,000 years ago, modern humans encountered another human species, Neanderthals. Descended from humans who left Africa in an earlier migration, Neanderthals were a hardy people whose stocky, muscular bodies helped them survive their harsh environment. They walked upright, had larger brains than modern humans, produced tools, and buried their dead with rituals. At one time, Neanderthals were widespread across Europe and into Eurasia. But by about 28,000 years ago, they were extinct. Theories for their demise abound. They may have been unable to adapt to the changing, colder climate, or they may have been outcompeted or simply massacred by modern humans with better tools and a more flexible social organization. Or less likely, they were simply absorbed into the modern human bloodline through interbreeding. In 2009, Swedish biologist Svante Paabo, and I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but anyway, this Swedish biologist and colleagues completed the first draft of an analysis of the Neanderthal genome. They found that modern Europeans and Asians shared 2.5% of their genome with Neanderthals. Although they may not have disappeared completely into the modern human lineage, many of us are just a little bit Neanderthal. But that still doesn't answer the question, what happened to the Neanderthals? And that remains a mystery. Maybe we will know about it in the future, maybe we won't. But it's definitely one of the questions to add to our great mystery series. And now we come to the very last question of today's episode, and that has to do with the universe. We're not going to talk about how the universe started. We're going to ask the question, how will the universe end? Well, that might be one of the greatest mysteries ever. So that's coming next. Don't go away. In the movie Annie Hall, young Alvy Singer has stopped doing his homework because the universe is expanding. And here I quote from the movie, "And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that would be the end of everything. So what's the point?" Alvy is not wrong, about the universe at least. It is expanding and will someday come to an end as we know it. The nature of that end, however, is still an open question. Depending upon the total amount of matter and energy in the universe, one of three models will probably apply. The Big Crunch, the Big Chill, or the Big Rip. In the Big Crunch, there is enough mass in the universe to slow and then reverse expansion so that the universe collapses back in upon itself. In the Big Chill, there is not enough mass to stop expansion and galaxies slowly drift apart as they cool and grow dark. In the Big Rip, an accelerating universe propelled by dark energy tears itself to shreds, right down to its atoms. Astronomers think the Big Crunch is unlikely based upon what we know now about matter in the universe. Which of the other two will come to pass depends upon what we learn about those mysterious subjects, dark matter and dark energy. But obviously, we don't have a clue. And we might never have a clue because it is too big. Or I may stand corrected in a couple of decades and scientists may come to a definitive answer to this question, to what the dark matter or dark energy is and everything there is in the universe as we know it. Or we might encounter some more intelligent species that would tell us about all that. Just like in the movies, right? But anyway, that was the last question in today's episode, our second episode in Great Mystery Series. With that being said, I would like to thank you very much for listening. This is your host, Danny. I will see you next time.